Lauren Spearer was a 20-year-old college student at Indiana University. Her disappearance in June of 2001 would become one of the most well-known disappearances in United States history. There has been a lot of speculation and rumours about what happened that night, as well as the reluctance of those with her that night to speak to the police and the refusal from the Bloomington State Police to release surveillance footage featuring Lauren. But what is the most haunting about this case is Lauren herself. She was beautiful, bright, and well-liked. She disappeared walking only a few blocks from her home after celebrating the end of semester with her friends. And now, more than 7 years later, no trace of Lauren Spearer has ever been found. Hello and welcome to Insight. My name is Ali, and with me today, as always, is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I am doing well. It's nice and chilly here, though it's warm where I'm sitting in my little closet to record.
It's really hot here, and I'm in my cold basement recording, so I feel like we've hit the perfect spot.
And like last week's case, this week is also a case that we've had requested a whole bunch of times. Tim, Jake, Catherine, and Olivia are the first four that requested it. And that's the case of the disappearance of Lauren Spearer. Lauren Spearer was born on January 17, 1991, to parents Charlene and Robert Spearer. She was raised in the upper-class suburb of Scarsdale, which is a small town of just over 17,000 people, and it's only a short train ride from New York City. In 2009, Lauren would graduate from Edgemont High School and move to Indiana that year to begin studying for a bachelor's degree in textiles and merchandising. She enrolled in Indiana University along with a close circle of friends and her boyfriend Jesse Wolf. The two had been dating for 2 years, but they had met at summer camp years earlier in Pennsylvania. Summer camp would be where she also met some of her closest friends, including Jay Rosenbaum. And remember Jay and Jesse because they will become important later in the story. It is said that Lauren excelled in her studies, but managed to balance that with a very active social life. She was friendly and outgoing, and she was the kind of person that people just wanted to be around. She got along with everyone. Lauren was religious and took her Jewish faith very seriously. She was extremely active in the Jewish community at Indiana University. She had actually spent the previous summer break in 2008 in Israel planting trees with the Jewish National Fund. Lauren was close with her parents, so much so she would call her mother every single day to check in with her and talk with her. She also had a very close circle of friends at school. And while all of this was true, Lauren was a good kid and did well in school, she had been arrested for public intoxication and illegal consumption of alcohol because she was underage, being only 19 at the time. And the legal drinking age in that part of the United States is 21. This was roughly 9 months before she disappeared, on September 2, 2010, at a tailgate party outside an Indiana University football game.
Only hours before she went missing, Lauren and her friends were getting ready to go out for a night out. It was June 3rd, 2011, and they were at a friend's apartment in the Smallwood Plaza apartment complex, which is the same complex that Lauren also lived in. The semester had just ended, so this is leading into summer break. They were just looking for a night out at a local sports bar, casual, just celebrate the end of the year, have some fun. Because it was casual, Lauren was just wearing sneakers, black leggings, white shirt. And this group of friends, they were close, and they were just ready to go out and have a good time. At around 12:46 a.m., she left the apartment with David Ron, who was a good friend of hers. They headed over to Jay Rosenbaum's house with plans to go with him to the bar. Eventually, Jay's neighbor, Corey Rossman, joined the group. Now, Corey is not someone Lauren knew before this night, though she did end up spending the bulk of her evening with him. According to a friend of Corey's, Corey would later tell him that he and Lauren were enjoying each other's company and just enjoying their time at Jay's house, quote-unquote pre-gaming. Pre-gaming meaning, of course, drinking before going out to the bar. The group continued to drink there for about an hour. Then they left for Kilroy Sports Bar shortly after 1:30 in the morning. At 1:46 a.m., Lauren was seen with Corey entering the sports bar, which was and is an extremely popular spot with students in the area. She had to use a fake ID to get in. We know the time of Lauren entering and leaving the bar and who she was with through the timestamps on the surveillance footage. The footage has not been released by Bloomington police, and this is despite the Spearer family requesting it to be released a number of times. And I'm under the impression that not even the family has been shown all of this footage.
No, from what I can understand, they haven't been showed any of the footage.
We have to assume they're not releasing it because they don't think it'll benefit the case. Like, they don't think there's a person of interest that needs to be identified or people or vehicles in the footage. It's possible there is something of evidentiary value on the footage that the police don't want to leak out that is important to their investigation. It's possible there's really nothing there and police don't want the footage to become a distraction. You know how much I know our listeners probably do the same thing we do and watch those videos over and over again when they do release footage. Maybe the police thought it would become too much of a distraction.
I get the frustration on the Spearer family side and there is more frustration to come, but there is a lack of trust I can see with the Spearer family and the Bloomington police that they don't trust that they aren't releasing the footage for a reason.
I've definitely heard that as well in the interviews with the family. And it is an unusual move not to release it. And they even delayed releasing some stills that you would have thought would have been pretty important to release. Like the one that's out there of Lauren that shows clearly what she was wearing. And so if you're on the lookout for a missing person, seeing what she was wearing, how she had her hair done that day, seems kind of important. There was also a still of a white truck that had been seen in the area. In so many other cases, we see the release of these types of videos, including the episode we just released last week. Regardless, by the time Lauren got to the bar, eyewitnesses would report that she and her friends were already intoxicated to the point that Lauren was seen falling down several times in the 30 minutes she was in the bar. And at some point in these 30 minutes, Lauren took off her shoes. It's reported that it was a beach-themed evening at the bar, and that's why she took her shoes off. I mean, sometimes women will take their shoes off because they're intoxicated. These were sneakers, not heels, so I don't know that that would be the case in this. But when she left the bar with Corey to head back to her apartment, she left her shoes at the bar, and she also left her cell phone.
Honestly, to me, this shows that Lauren obviously had drunk too much. She was a tiny petite girl, and even if she had a history of binge drinking, I couldn't imagine it would take that much to get her to a certain state. And remember, she had been pre-drinking at possibly her apartment. We know she was at a friend's apartment and then Jay's apartment before even getting to the bar. I'm sure a lot of us have been to a bar and left things behind. I always make sure I know where my cell phone is. That's my connection to get help, to get a lift. And for her to leave that phone behind, it definitely shows that she wasn't thinking straight that night. An interesting fact that I do want to point out, during this whole evening, Lauren's boyfriend, Jesse Wolf, was not present. Apparently, he did stay home that night and was watching a basketball game and wanted to go to bed early. There is nothing unusual about that, but it's just an interesting side note that Lauren was out with a bunch of male friends and Jesse didn't seem to mind. Again, nothing unusual about that. They may have had a very trusting relationship. But according to Jesse, the two were texting back and forth all night, and he didn't seem concerned that Lauren was that intoxicated with people that she really didn't know and being out that time of night at times alone. Regardless, at 2:30 a.m., Lauren left Kilroy Sports Bar with Corey to head to her apartment. They walked about a block away to the Smallwood Plaza apartment complex where she lived. Now, this apartment complex was an off-campus student accommodation building. Lauren lived on the fifth floor. We know that Lauren made it this far because surveillance cameras would show Lauren entering her apartment complex only minutes after leaving the sports bar. But the surveillance footage would show both Lauren and Corey struggling to even walk at this point. They were stumbling all over the place. Another Indiana University student, Zach Oakes, who also lived at the apartment complex, he noticed how intoxicated Lauren was and he stopped to make sure that she was okay. In the 2020 special on Lauren's disappearance, which we will link in the Facebook group and on the website, an FBI agent who worked on Lauren's disappearance, Brad Garrett, he claimed that when they were leaving the apartment complex, Corey would get into a physical altercation with four of Lauren's neighbours, who, like Zach and Lauren, were also Indiana University students. They were worried about how he was handling Lauren. I'm not sure exactly what Corey was doing here, how he was handling her. I couldn't find anywhere in my research, and the 2020 special doesn't go into specifics. It's only said that these four students were uncomfortable with the way that he was handling her, enough so that it alarmed them when combined with just how intoxicated Lauren was. I'm not sure if they approached Corey and Lauren first, or they just said something and Corey confronted them, but when the pair were approached, again to make sure that Lauren was okay, Corey then said something to the effect of, "I've got it handled." And then there was an altercation that ended with Corey being punched in the face.
After this, Lauren and Corey left her apartment complex and went instead to Corey's apartment. It's unclear why they went to her apartment in the first place, which leaves things open to speculation. One thought is that they went there for drugs, and we will come back to that later. Another idea is that Corey was leading her back there, possibly to take advantage of her intoxicated state, though he was also heavily intoxicated, so there are some questions here on both their abilities to consent. Corey has never revealed why they went back to Lauren's apartment, but they didn't stay after this altercation. They left and went to Corey's instead. At 3 a.m., Lauren was spotted going down an alleyway between College Avenue and Morton Street at what I believe is 11th Street, and her apartment's at 9th and College. So this was just about a third of a mile from her apartment. During this time, Lauren dropped her keys and she dropped her purse. According to what's been reported from the surveillance footage from that alleyway, Lauren fell down two times. Now, the first time she got back up on her own, the second time Corey pretty much had to pick her up. And he threw her over his shoulder in what's called the fireman's carry position. And they continued their journey to his apartment, which was just about a block further away. There is no surveillance footage to back up that this is how they left the area, though. There's only footage of the alleyway. The Spear family would later hire a private investigator who would speak to a local bar manager who says he saw this all happen. The problem with the sighting is the bar manager would be adamant this happened about a half an hour later, when, as will become clear pretty soon, that's just not possible. I can't think of a reason the bar owner would necessarily lie about seeing them. My guess is maybe he saw another couple other than Corey and Lauren. I doubt they were the only two drunk people out that night, or he was mistaken on the time. We've seen cases before where people are convinced their memory is correct when what they're saying is actually impossible.
A half an hour isn't that big a difference of time, and I don't think the bar manager was clock watching. I doubt he was. So it's reasonable to be out half an hour. That's not a long period of time.
No, especially not this so late at night. I know when I'm up for a while and I'm late at night and I'm working, time just doesn't seem to work the same as it does during the day. So I can definitely see him just being off. They did make it to Corey's apartment, and he shared that apartment with a roommate named Michael Beth. Corey vomited on the front steps of the apartment, and Michael would later say that Corey did not look very well. And I mean, he was intoxicated, and he had just been punched in the head. So whether he vomited because of the intoxication, possibly because he had a concussion, I just don't imagine he was looking that great at this point. And Michael Beth also reported what we've heard up to this point. Corey and Lauren were highly intoxicated, they were slurring words, and they were stumbling around. Michael managed to get Corey into bed, and he offered for Lauren to spend the night on the couch. Lauren declined this offer and instead went to the next door apartment, which was Jay Rosenbaum's, which you may remember from the beginning of the episode. That's the apartment where Lauren initially met Corey.
After Lauren left his apartment, Michael does call Jay to try and get him to convince Lauren to stay at his apartment and not walk home alone. Michael's line of thinking was that Jay had known Lauren for years and she may listen to Jay more than him. Jay would later report that he noticed a bruise under Lauren's eye, which is assumed to be due to one of the many falls Lauren took that evening, I'd say most likely in the alleyway. Jay did ask her how she got the bruise, but she told him that she didn't know. Jay did try to convince Lauren to stay with him, to sleep it off on the couch. This doesn't work, but before she leaves, Lauren does make two phone calls. Because she doesn't have her cell phone, she uses Jay's. Police would later check Jay's cell phone records, and two calls were made around this time. The first was to David Roan, and remember that David was the friend that she left the apartment with at the beginning of the night. And the second call was to another friend who has never been officially named. Neither friend answered Lauren's calls, and she didn't leave a message to either of them. Lauren left Jay's apartment about an hour after she arrived, so around 4:30 a.m. It's important to note at this time that Lauren doesn't have her shoes, her cell phone, her keys, or her purse. Jay would be the last person to see Lauren alive, walking south along College Avenue near the corner of 11th Street. Now, I do wish that one of these guys could have taken the responsibility and walked her back to her apartment. She may have refused that. They may have offered that and she refused that. They obviously all saw she wasn't doing well when they did try to get her to stay at one point or another, yet she does leave on her own. There is an unsubstantiated rumour on online true crime and unsolved mysteries forums that I really haven't seen repeated anywhere that I would deem a reliable source. But about 5 minutes after Lauren left Jay's apartment, there are reports that a homeless man heard a woman scream for help near where Lauren was last seen. From what I've read about this, apparently investigators did try to follow this up, but no one could even confirm who this homeless man was, let alone that this actually happened. Allegedly, he may have died a few weeks after Lauren's disappearance, but again, this hasn't been confirmed, so take from that what you will. Later that morning, Lauren's boyfriend, Jesse Wolf, would text Lauren to ask how she was doing and how the night ended. The reply he received wasn't from Lauren, but a staff member from the Kilroy Sports Bar. And it said that Lauren wasn't there and that she'd left her phone at the bar. He checked her apartment. She wasn't there. She wasn't with anyone else she was known to be out with that night. The news that Lauren was missing spreads fast within the close-knit circle of friends. Lauren's sister contacts their parents to let them know that no one knows where Lauren is. When they contact Jesse to see if he knows anything else, he is already at the Bloomington police station reporting his girlfriend missing. We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Brooklinen. I have been using my Brooklinen sheets for about a year now, and here they are, still on my bed. I have three sets on rotation, and they are the only sheets and comforters that I will use now. They have kept their shape and colours after numerous washes. I cannot recommend them more. I'm a big fan of sleep, and they honestly make a difference to how I sleep. It's time that you started getting a better sleep with the best sheets too. Brooklinen is the fastest growing bedding brand in the world with over 20,000 five-star reviews. Not only that, but Brooklinen sheets were named the winner of the best of online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. And not only are they comfortable and practical, but they look good too. With versatile colours and patterns, you really can mix and match to complement any decor. My Brooklinen sheets are the best, most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for our listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. Brooklinen is so confident that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code SITE at Brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen.com, promo code SITE.
Police almost immediately knew that in this case, they might be dealing with foul play. Due to her intoxicated state, they believed that she probably didn't get much further than where she was last seen. Within days of her disappearance, multiple searches were conducted by thousands of volunteers, police officials, the FBI, and family and friends of the Spearers. Over a 9-day period, they extensively searched the area near Lauren's apartment, including the Sycamore Ridge landfill going through 41 tons of trash. We cannot even explain how massive these searches were. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children heard about Lauren's disappearance, and they sent a rapid response team to assist in the search. The Indiana State Police were assisting with the investigation, and they deployed 192 officers who spent over 1,300 hours in the search for Lauren. Police divers scoured Lake Monroe for days, looking for any evidence that Lauren or her remains might be there. Search dogs and cadaver dogs were taken into the Hoosier National Park, the Morgan Monroe State Forest, which are all right in this area. Despite their best efforts, though, the searches would ultimately prove entirely fruitless. No trace of Lauren was ever found. The Spear family put forward a $250,000 reward in the hopes that someone would give them information that would reveal Lauren's whereabouts. This led to hundreds of tips coming in, but nothing led to any answers.
This case immediately made headlines throughout the United States, and it also received international coverage. As we said, the FBI was involved, the police were involved, numerous agencies and organizations were involved. You often see this case mentioned in articles about missing white woman syndrome just because of how much media attention it did receive in comparison to those involving women of color. And we have talked about missing white woman syndrome before on a whole bunch of episodes. One that comes to mind was back in episode 64 when I discussed the death of Matrice Richardson with Zach from Mystery Yes. But with Lauren's disappearance, the FBI became involved very early on. And it seemed that Lauren's disappearance was headline news nationally, which is great and how it should have been. But it's just another example of how sometimes white women are treated differently in the media when they are missing or a victim of crime than sometimes a person of colour or a person who is not educated or from a lower socioeconomic background or with mental illnesses, or maybe they have a different lifestyle. And I could go on, but again, there is nothing wrong or bad when a case does get wide and extensive exposure. that can prove invaluable in solving a case, especially in the early days. But this is one of the reasons why Charlie and I try to cover the lesser known cases more often than not in the podcasts we are involved in. And it is harder because generally there is less information and we have to dig that much harder in our research to get enough information to make an episode. But to us, it is important when we do choose the cases. And then there are cases like Lauren's that the media does really cover extensively. She is that pretty blonde college-age woman that catches the public's eyes and does get that sympathy.
And I know it makes people uncomfortable sometimes, and people even get called out, being told they're being racist or that this missing white woman syndrome doesn't exist. I've seen it happen with our podcast, with other podcasts. When we do bring up these disparities in the coverage of cases of white women versus black women or upper middle class women to those who live below the poverty line. But the research supports that this does exist and that it goes even deeper than just the amount of coverage. In the cases of violent crimes against black women, their past, such as any arrest history, relationship instability, that will be brought up more often in the coverage than when we're talking about a white woman. People can deny that it happens. You can explain it away, rationalize it, but look into the research and see what is actually saying. Again and again, the research is telling us that it is happening. And it's not that anyone thinks Lauren shouldn't get this type of coverage. She absolutely deserves this coverage. As her family felt the police were shutting them out and not listening to them, I can only imagine how beneficial it was to them and to Lauren's case for the media and the public to be listening to them. I just wish more families could get that coverage because there are more out there who also need it. Let's move on to talk about some of the suspects in this case. And we say suspects, persons of interest, people who are suspicious. We're not saying these are necessarily people who have been named as suspects by the police. Obviously, suspicion immediately fell on the three men who were last seen with Lauren. And these three men immediately lawyered up. And based on their attorney's advice, they all refused to take police-issued polygraphs. Now, we're not judging innocence or guilt here for Jay, Michael, and Corey for hiring lawyers. It's not uncommon for people who feel they're considered persons of interest in a case to do this. And we may have mentioned this as a PSA in an earlier episode, hire an attorney. Before you talk to the police, if you are an attorney, then you would know you're going to hire an attorney. Attorney's advice, before you talk to the police, talk to an attorney so that you know your rights and that they're protected, that you're not persuaded in any way. We've talked about the Reed technique in passing as a means of getting confessions. An attorney isn't there to stop you necessarily from talking to the police, but rather to protect you. Though they may stop you from talking to the police, and that's what largely happened here. Now, personally, I don't find not taking the polygraph suspicious. I think they're pretty unreliable. So I'm stating right now, I probably wouldn't take one. And they also publicly said they didn't trust the Bloomington police specifically, which might sound suspicious, but like we said, Lauren's family said the same thing. They don't really trust them. Lauren's boyfriend, Jesse, was also interviewed early on in the investigation. In stark contrast to the other men, he was extremely cooperative. His roommate did confirm his alibi. Jesse was doing exactly what he said he was doing. He was at home. He watched basketball while Lauren was out that night. And then he went to bed around 2:30. And that's 2 hours before Lauren was last seen. Because of this alibi, police do not consider him a suspect in Lauren's disappearance. He did not take the police polygraph, but his parents told USA Today that it's the same reasons the other men didn't. They didn't trust the police. He did take and pass a private one, and he also stayed and helped search for Lauren those first 2 days. On the other hand, Lauren's parents, Charlene and Robert, have been very vocal with their thoughts and suspicions here. Even though Jesse did help search that weekend, his parents came and got him and brought him back to New York that Monday. That seemed odd to them. They weren't 100% convinced that Jesse did not have any involvement or any knowledge of what went on with their daughter's disappearance. It was summer break. We don't know if Jesse already planned to head back to New York at this point. Maybe he was very upset or distraught about Lauren's disappearance, that his parents were worried, or they were worried about the investigation and wanted to get him home where they could protect him. There could be different ways to look at this. Lauren's parents have also said that out of the three men police were interested in talking with, they believed Corey Rossman was the least cooperative with the police. Now, as we know, he was the one who spent the most time with Lauren that night. Their suspicions seem warranted. He's the only one who refused to speak with them or their private investigator. He did provide a DNA sample to the police early on in the investigation. And this is something they've done. They've collected DNA samples from people in the event they ever have something to test it against. And Corey's always maintained his innocence. He claims he actually has a pretty limited memory of that night, especially after that point he was punched in the face at Lauren's apartment complex. Between that possible concussion, between the drinking, he says most of the night is a blur, maybe even a full blackout. He's adamant that the last time he saw Lauren was when he was put to bed by his roommate, Michael, and she was still in the apartment. All of the men have publicly stated that they have taken privately administered polygraphs, as well as some of them may have taken ones administered by the FBI, not the Bloomington police, though. And like Corey, Michael and Jay also have continued to maintain innocence.
We just need to take a quick break for a word about our other sponsor this week, Be Scared Podcast. If you are a fan of horror, thrillers, or mysterious unexplained events like I am, I recommend you check out the new horror podcast, Be Scared. Be Scared is a Castbox original produced alongside Studio 71. Each 30-minute episode contains short stories carefully curated to make those little hairs on the back of your neck stand straight up. They cover stories from alien parasites to involuntary time travel to those good old-fashioned monsters lurking in the dark. Be Scared will fuel your nightmares with a smile. Narrated by a fellow Australian, Bea Buster, tune in weekly for tales of mystery, unexplained events and horror that will keep you up at night, but in the best way. Turn out the lights, settle in, and listen to Be Scared, BESCARED, on CastBox, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And after you listen, make sure you rate and review, as every little bit helps. Back to the 2020 special, it was alluded to that drugs played a part in Lauren's disappearance that night, and that they played a part in, quote-unquote, either in her own demise or because it placed her in harm's way because she was so impaired. There were reports made to the police by her boyfriend, Jesse Wolfe, and other friends that Lauren did take drugs and did drink alcohol on a regular basis leading up to her disappearance. And when police did search her apartment looking for clues as to what happened to her, they allegedly found a small amount of cocaine. And we do know that she was arrested for underage drinking and public intoxication the year before she disappeared. There was another incident alleged by Jesse's mother, Nadine. She claimed that Lauren was kicked out of the summer camp before going to university because of drug use. But back to the night she went missing, during his police interview, Jay said that Lauren snorted Klonopin and cocaine that night, as well as drinking substantial amounts of alcohol before she was last seen. Something else that may come into play with her disappearance: her parents, Charlene and Robert, flew to Indiana to assist with the search, and in a press conference early in her disappearance, they revealed that Lauren suffered from long QT syndrome. And what long QT syndrome is, it's the disruption of the heart's arrhythmias, which can cause it to be irregular and erratic and can prove to be fatal if not properly treated. If you look into this syndrome, symptoms can be fainting, seizures, and in severe cases, even death. It would be important for Lauren to have access to medical help or her medication if she was having one of these events. But add on drug use and alcohol into Lauren's system, all of this would have increased the likelihood of the occurrence of the symptoms of Lauren's disorder. Investigators did consider for a time that she may have overdosed in front of her friends and they hid her body. Lauren's family don't believe that this happened and that she was even a drug user. They don't even believe that her level of intoxication that was reported by witnesses was due to the amount she was drinking. What they believe is that she was drugged when she was at the bar. And while it's not what I think that's happened, this does happen and far too frequently, especially around college campuses. It is something that you do need to be careful about when you are out and drinking. That's why it's important not to go out drinking alone. You need to be careful and have a friend there to watch your drink and you watch theirs, because it only takes a second for someone to slip something into your drink. I think we have reached our PSA limit this episode, so I'll leave it there.
2012, Charlene Spear acknowledged for the first time that she doubted her daughter was still alive. She said that she thought at this stage, a year later, the odds were against them. In June of 2013, Charlene and Robert sued Corey Rossman, Jay Rosenbaum, and Michael Beth, the last three men to be seen with Lauren, for wrongful death. They argued that the men had a duty of care because they knew Lauren was so heavily intoxicated. Both Corey and Jay had provided Lauren with alcohol throughout the night, even though they knew she was intoxicated, and then they let her leave the apartment in that condition. This didn't prove successful, though. Michael Beth was dismissed from the lawsuit first and very early on. Then in 2014, the judge dismissed the lawsuit against the other two men. She ruled that the men did not have a legal duty of care to ensure Lauren was safe or got home safely. They offered her their couches to sleep on, and it was her decision as an adult to either deny or accept it. And there is concern here that holding someone responsible for a peer like this would make people less willing to help. So if you look at Michael, for example, all he did that night was offer a place to crash. He then called her friend to see if he could help. Holding him responsible for what happened next would discourage people from attempting to help at all, since they would be liable if their help wasn't enough. That's the judge's ruling. And the attorneys for the other men, not Michael, they pointed out that we don't even know if Lauren is alive or not, so it's hard to charge a wrongful death when a missing person has not been missing long enough to be declared dead. The judge did point out that even if Lauren was deceased, there were any number of scenarios of what could have happened to Lauren. If her death was unrelated to her intoxication, then the men had no liability whatsoever. So without a cause of death, there really was no case. Now, it's my personal belief that this lawsuit was more about forcing the men to make official on-the-record statements than it ever was about holding them responsible for what happened to Lauren. I mean, these poor parents, they just want to know what happened to their daughter. But without more of a foundation, the judge had no choice but to dismiss it. They then appealed this decision to dismiss the case against Jay and Corey. But in August 2015, the appeals court upheld the lower court's ruling. They said there's just nothing in Indiana law or in previous cases that would hold a person liable for the choices of their peers. Basically, alcohol may have been provided, but these were not people in authority who could make Lauren drink, that she made her own choice. Specifically on Corey providing her with so much alcohol, the court pointed out that he was also highly intoxicated and, quote, it is questionable whether he could effectively take care of himself, still less another person. After this appeal was denied, no further action has been taken.
The case went cold and there were no more developments until as recently as 2015. And that is when Lauren's disappearance was linked to the abduction and murder of Hannah Wilson. Hannah Wilson was also a student at Indiana University, And on April 24, 2015, she was also out at Kilroy Sports Bar. Hannah was last seen leaving in a taxi from the bar. The next day, her body was found only 10 miles away from campus. Underneath her body, police found a cell phone that was traced back to 51-year-old Daniel Messel, who worked at the local print shop. Messel would later be arrested and convicted of the crime, and he was sentenced to 45 to 65 years in prison. The prosecutor for the case, Ted Adams, strongly believes that Daniel Messel was behind the disappearance of Lauren Spearer. According to Adams, when they were piecing together the evidence in Hannah's case, what they learnt was that in the summer and fall of 2012, five women were harassed, with one of these women actually being assaulted. And they believe that Messel was responsible for these attacks. What I find even more concerning is that Adams said that Messel would commit his crimes in what is known as danger areas. He said that one of these danger areas was where Hannah was abducted, which then circles back around to where Lauren was last seen alive. Lauren last being seen in 10th Street, while Hannah was abducted by Messel on 8th Street and Grand. If you look on the map, these locations are very close to one another, and both Hannah and Lauren disappeared in the early morning hours. Messel is currently facing sexual assault charges from a 2012 assault, and he is currently appealing his conviction. The Spearer's investigator has said that he doesn't believe the two cases are related, and the police have all but said the same thing. They haven't commented too much on Lauren and Hannah's case being possibly connected because of the active case against Messel.
Finally, in January 2016, the FBI and local police began to investigate a property belonging to the family of Justin Wagers, and he was a registered sex offender due to a record of indecent exposure. We aren't 100% sure what led them to Wagers, except that a tip came in, and we don't know the details of that tip. But this tip had to have been pretty significant because authorities had probable cause to get a search warrant. Cadaver dogs were brought in for the searches of the property he was living at the time of Lauren's disappearance. The dogs did get a hit, resulting in forensic investigators digging up specific sections of the property to look for evidence, but nothing definitive was found. There was a white truck found, and there was a surveillance of a white truck circling the block where Lauren was last seen, but white trucks are pretty common. Like I said, we don't really know the details. These warrants have been sealed, and the lead investigator has said this information is not going to be made public. Wagers does not have a past of violence. However, he was convicted on an intimidation charge when he harassed a woman, calling her dozens of times and telling her to say goodbye to her friends and family and that she would be sorry for hurting him. And that's basically all the information about this case and the investigation to date, which brings us to the theories. And there are a lot of theories in this case. A lot of them are far-fetched or based solely on speculation. So tonight we're going to cover the theories that just come up the most often.
The first theory is that one or all of the men that Lauren was last seen with had something to do with her disappearance. Lauren's parents, Charlene and Robert, had come out and said that they simply do not believe these men have been completely honest with everything they know about what happened to Lauren. As we've said a whole bunch of times now, Lauren was extremely intoxicated that night. Everyone that saw her that night would later report her to be stumbling around, slurring her words, and the surveillance video picked her up falling down at least twice. She clearly was not in the right state of mind. It is possible that something did happen that night in either Corey or Jay's apartment. It could have been intentional, it could have been accidental. According to eyewitness accounts, we do know that Corey was acting aggressively with Lauren that night. Again, the men at Lauren's apartment complex did say they were alarmed with how Corey was handling her. It literally led to Corey being assaulted. It is possible that Corey may have made an advance and Lauren rejected him, which set him off. Maybe it was truly an accident. As we said earlier, it has been speculated that Lauren had possibly overdosed that night. The men she was with that night told investigators she was doing drugs. The cocaine and the Klonopin, as well as the high amounts of alcohol she drank, when combined with her heart condition and just her size, she was only tiny, being only 4'11" and 95 pounds. It is possible that when Lauren got back to Corey or Jay's apartment that she did fall unconscious or she had some kind of seizure and that the men panicked and disposed of the body. We do know that the police have considered both of these theories, that she may have overdosed considering everything she consumed that night or she had some kind of seizure. Her long QT syndrome could definitely be a factor in that. But if this happened, then where is Lauren? If something happened to her and the men chose to not call the police, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, then where is she? Where did they take her? We know that police have done extensive searches of the area and they have found no trace of Lauren or her remains.
I don't know what makes people lean towards these men, except that they were the last ones to see her, and that does seem suspicious. But, you know, Jay was a really close friend of hers for years. Michael Beth just seemed to have been there, unluckily, that night, trying to get his drunk roommate to go to bed, trying to get this girl who seemed to need help, the help she needed. You can understand why Lauren wouldn't want to stay at Corey or Michael's because she didn't know them well. She probably would have felt safer at Jay's, and it's really too bad she didn't take him up on that. I'm not sure what, except that they were the last ones to see her, what more they could have known, because I think their story sounds pretty plausible. Another popular theory is that Lauren was abducted by an unknown person who was driving around Bloomington the night of her disappearance. And this would have been someone who saw a drunk, stumbling, shoeless Lauren as a target. Police have stated that surveillance footage from nearby businesses do show a white pickup truck driving around the area where Lauren was last seen. The private investigator who was hired by Lauren's parents has claimed that someone who should be of interest to police because he does drive this white pickup truck is James McClish. And he had recently been released from prison when Lauren went missing. His conviction was for a violent offense. He attacked his ex-wife. At the time Lauren went missing, McClish was living at a halfway house for recently released convicts just minutes away from where she was last seen. An anonymous tip came in about him from a woman who allegedly knew him and claimed that he had murdered Lauren and buried her on his farm. McClish was interviewed for the 2020 special on Lauren's disappearance, and he agreed to take a polygraph with cameras rolling. It was determined he was being honest and was not involved in Lauren's disappearance. And how persuasive this is has to do with your view on polygraphs. His name still comes up in discussions on the case, but it seems like both the police and the private investigator have ruled him out.
Following along the stranger abduction theory is another lead police received in 2012 that was sent to the Find Lauren website. That same year, Corey Hammersley, who was an Indiana University student like Lauren, he was arrested about a year after Lauren went missing after suffering a mental breakdown when he walked out of his apartment complex completely naked and shot at local police officers while under the influence of drugs. Hammersley was reportedly heavily involved in the drug culture at Indiana University, and he mixed in the same circles as Lauren. He was sentenced to 24 years in prison for his crime, and shortly after being sentenced, an inmate who was in the same cell block as Hammersley claimed that he said that he knew who killed Lauren. Hammersley was allegedly playing cards with this inmate when Lauren's story came on the news. Hammersley allegedly told this inmate that Lauren had overdosed on ecstasy, passed out. And then the people with her, not knowing what to do, they drove her down to the Ohio River and dumped her body there. Now, to me, this all seems ridiculous when you would think the most logical course of action here would be to call 911, not to dispose of a body when they had nothing to say that she was even dead. But according to this theory, these kids were drunk and privileged and were more concerned about something tarring their academic records. And like before, this theory does make some sense, especially when you consider that Lauren did suffer from a heart condition that could have led to an overdose or an adverse reaction to the drugs. For his part, though, the private investigator did go to the prison to interview Hammersley, and he denied any involvement in Lauren's disappearance. He has stated that he absolutely did not help move her body and doesn't know what happened to Lauren.
It seems like the strongest link to him is through a jailhouse informant. And jailhouse informants have way too much to gain for me to entirely believe them. I'm not really impressed with that as really solid evidence in any way.
Look, I don't believe this theory is what happened to Lauren. I really think that Hammersley was just trying to get some attention. Maybe he wanted to seem tough in front of the other inmates, or it's possible this inmate just made up the entire story. But I just don't think this is what happened.
And the next theory is that Daniel Messel was involved. To be honest, this seems possible, maybe even extremely possible. And if not him, someone like him. But for him, I mean, he's a convicted murderer. He abducted and killed Hannah Wilson. And there are all these parallels, the same school, they were seen at the same bar in the same area. Hannah was abducted in the early morning hours, which is just when Lauren was last seen. It seems like a pattern. And I think he definitely needs to be looked into in this case, and it sounds like they tried to, but the problem here is trying to prove it. Without a body or a crime scene, we don't have DNA to match anything to. What got him caught in Hannah's case was that he dropped his cell phone at her feet. So they had a crime scene and a body with which to link back to him. And then the previous sexual assault that he's been charged with, that was through a DNA match that he was linked to that. So I think this is definitely possible, but we need more evidence.
Look, unfortunately, given Lauren's size and her intoxicated state, she would have been a perfect victim for someone like Messel, who had this criminal history of assaulting and harassing young women. Messel did know the area very well, and it would have been easy for him to just grab Lauren. We are talking 4 a.m. here, and not many people would have been around at that time. Due to her state, I don't think Lauren would have had the reflexes to fight off someone bigger than her. I think it would have been extremely easy for someone, either Messel or someone like him, to just grab her.
I agree. I think this is possibly, I mean, I know we always say it's not some random serial killer or whatever, but in this case, I think it very possibly could have been, because everything was right. It was the perfect storm that if someone was out that night searching the area, they would have found Lauren. And I think that does make me lean towards it being something more opportunistic.
Unfortunately, I don't think that Lauren is still alive. Again, she regularly needed medication for her heart condition. Look, hypothetically, if she was being held against her will or if she was sold into sex trafficking, which both of these theories are out there, but I don't think it's very likely that she would be able to survive without that medication. This whole case is just so heartbreaking to me, and it has really affected me. Along the lines of the Kanika Jenkins case, this kind of thing could easily happen to me when I was Lauren's age. It happened to a lot of kids around Lauren's age. I really found it interesting how quickly people online and in the media, how quickly they were to judge Lauren's actions that night. because I think all of us have gotten ourselves into situations at least once in our lives where we have made the wrong decision or made a bad decision. We're not thinking clearly or thinking about all the possible consequences for our actions. I think people need to remember that Lauren was only 20. She was going into summer break. She wanted to have fun with her friends. And because of it, her guard would have been down. Did she make the right decisions that night? No, she didn't. But to learn this way, it's truly heartbreaking.
I think that's just such an important point. I know when something terrible happens, we want to find blame, and we don't have someone to blame here. So people start blaming Lauren for putting herself in that position for the choices she made. But like you said, if we all look back and take an honest look at things that we've done, decisions we've made, whether it's involving drinking or something even more mundane, like we looked at our phone while we were driving, and it's just our luck or the universe or whatever that nothing bad happened that time, that none of us walk through this life making perfect choices all the time, and that sometimes our choices and someone else's choices are going to collide in a really bad way. And you're, like you said, she didn't make great choices this night, but it sounds like there were a lot of people in Bloomington that night not making great choices. And Lauren is the one who, unfortunately, is the one who went missing. So I think it's hurtful to her parents. It's hurtful to Lauren's memory to spend so much time victim blaming when, in the end, the only person who chose to hurt Lauren that night, that's the person who's to blame.
As we have said, Charlene and Robert have vocally shared their frustrations with the police investigation, and it's completely understandable why. They have no idea where their daughter is or what happened to her. There are literally no leads and no evidence whatsoever. Every year on June 1st, they issue a plea on social media and their website looking for witnesses to come forward.
Lauren Spear was 20 years old at the time of her disappearance, but today she would be 27. She was petite. She was only 4'11", weighing about 95 pounds. She has blue eyes and blonde hair. Lauren's parents have made reference to Lauren suffering from long QT syndrome, and she would be in need to seek medical assistance for this condition. She was last seen wearing black leggings and a white shirt. Anyone with information about the case can contact the Bloomington Police Department at 812-339-4477 or email helpfindlauren@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at Insight Podcast, Twitter at Insightful Pod, Instagram at Insight Pod, or email us at insightfulpod@gmail.com. You can also support the show at patreon.com/insightpod. And a special thank you to Chesgrave Music for our new custom theme.